Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, today here in beautiful Urbana on AL 580. Today we're going to be talking about labor in the news, labor and journalism in the United States. Whatever happened to it? What sort of coverage do working people get, do poor people get of their issues that they're interested in the news? And how has that changed and what is being done about it? And we're very privileged today to have two terrific guests on the line with us. One from Massachusetts is the national correspondent, political correspondent for The Nation magazine, John Nichols. John, are you there?
I am here. I'm glad to be with you, Bob.
Thank you very much for joining us, John. John has worked for labor and covered labor and business and political journalism in general for the past two decades. Also with us from Madison, Wisconsin is Frank Emsbeck. Frank, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great, Frank. Frank is a professor of the at the School for Workers at the University of Wisconsin, and he's been hard at work on a group called the Workers, an institution or a program called the Workers News Service, which is about bringing labor journalism to radio. Frank, why don't you just real quickly tell us in just a couple sentences what the Workers News Service does? And I want to get back to it later, but then I want to talk more about labor in the media in general.
The Workers Independent News Service is a headline news service for radio, providing news, headlines, and features to radio stations throughout the country about the issues and concerns of working people. So we focus on those issues, so instead of a stock market report every day, we have what we call our Dow Bob report, a little pun on the stock market, but it talks about unemployment, workers' injuries, income disparity, housing starts, and things that concern most people.
So terrific. And how old is the Workers Independent News Service now, Frank?
We went on the air or started providing material on February 18th.
Okay. Now, for our listeners who want to call in, I'll just give you the numbers right now. We'll have plenty of time to take calls today. The numbers are 333-9455 for local calls. 1-800-222-9455 is our toll-free number. Frank, what was the motivation that led to the rise of the Workers Independent News Service? What was the critique you had of existing journalism that led you to think this was something that was needed?
Well, the fact that you could drive around the country on commercial radio and not hear anything about workers or our concerns, or if you heard it, it was always from the point of view of the employer. So it was very, very hard to figure out what, for instance, a strike or an issue was about. It was sort of one-sided news, and we felt that it would be a good thing, a popular thing, for other working people to hear about what other working people are doing.
John Nichols, you've been a journalist for two decades now covering political news. What about the argument that, you know, news is supposed to cover people who are important and workers aren't important? Isn't that what's going on here?
Well, it goes way beyond that, though. The it used to be in the, say, like 1940s, this country had more than 1,000 labor journalists, people who were covering unions specifically. And now we're down to about 10 or less. And you can't tell me that unions and working people have become that much less important in the last 50 to 60 years. The reality is that media itself has changed. It's become far more focused on really reporting on business from a standpoint not of, you know, a critique or a challenge or even an investigation, but rather cheerleading. And when you're cheerleading for business, there's not much room for labor reporting.
Let's back up there for a second. You said there were about 1,000 full-time labor reporters on daily newspapers in this country?
Yeah, actually more than that. Yeah.
That's extraordinary. I mean,
go ahead.
Well, can you give, I mean, so how would that, for the average person living in Urbana or Champaign or Chicago, Illinois, reading their newspaper or listening to the radio, how would that affect the news that you would have heard in 1948 compared to the news you'd hear in 1992 or 2002?
I can give you a dramatic example.
Okay.
And I'll give you an example actually from the 1930s. And I used to work for a newspaper called the Toledo Blade. And I went back one day and was doing one of those things, those features you do where you look at what the paper ran 50 years before.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a random front page of the paper from 50 years before that date, took a look. There were three front page stories about the activities of labor unions, one about a strike, one about an organizing effort, and one about an effort of a union to create a housing cooperative in the community. And I think that if you multiply that times 1,000 all over the country, what you have is a whole different sort of coverage. You have a look at what workers' organizations are doing on a daily basis sometimes strikes, and yes, that is sort of a clashy, newsworthy, so-called story, but also just as community institutions. This is the crisis. We now have a situation where workers identify almost entirely, or are identified almost entirely, by who they work for, i.e. who they get their salary from or their pay from, rather than by what they organize themselves, the institutions they create. The tragedy of that is that the institutions they create are often much more long-lasting, much more significant to communities, and do much more of a contribution than the fly-by-night corporations they work for.
Well, what accounts for this change, John Nichols? I mean, why? I mean, it wasn't like newspapers in the 1940s and 30s in the United States were pro-labor institutions. They were overwhelmingly, all studies show, conservative in traditional political sense and very sympathetic to the needs of business. Why were they covering labor so much then, and why has it dropped?
Well, the answer is actually very simple. In the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, most newspapers were locally owned. And that meant that the person who made the decisions, who called the shots at the paper, was someone who lived in the community where it existed. Now, that person was usually a conservative, but the bottom line was they recognized what was going on around them, and they felt a necessity, often a pressure, to cover it accurately because they'd see the people on a day-to-day basis. In the last 20 to 30 years, we've seen a massive conglomeration of newspaper ownership into monopoly chains run out of distant cities. They have no interest in what goes on day-to-day in the communities they cover. They just want to get the most profit out of those communities. And so they're much more interested in producing a packet of news you can use, happy news, and by the nature of it, labor falls quickly by the wayside, both because they're cutting the number of reporters and also because they don't really want to report on things that their advertisers, i.e. businesses, aren't particularly interested in having reported.
Frank Emspach, from your experience, and I know you've been active in the labor movement for three decades, if not more, was what John Nichols just said surprise you?
No, it's not surprising. I think there's a couple of other factors in terms of the newspapers. I think John is absolutely right. I think we've seen a similar thing with radio, but we've also seen that there used to be a labor service called the Federated Press, which was basically destroyed during the McCarthyism period in this country. So it was not just a benign sort of evolution, which did occur, and it wasn't so benign, but there was also more active repression of people who were in the media because a lot of them were progressive people or left-wing people. So,
no, Frank, clarify this for our listeners who might not know their media history. The Federated Press was a news service like the Associated Press?
Yes, for labor, and it flourished from about 1925 until about 1950, and they produced news, primarily for written news, journalist, you know, newspaper news. They had people at all these major labor issues, sort of like stringers, and provided news to most of the union papers in the country and a substantial number of papers that John was describing. So you'd see a little Federated Press thing like Associated Press. But the reason, and I think John is right, the reason we decided to try radio is because still, in spite of the conglomeration and the agglomeration, there is a little bit more freedom in radio. And secondly, it's easier for us to distribute it because we can use modern technology, the Internet. And so we think that there is a sort of window of opportunity here. But I agree, by and large, with John, with the addition of also a more bunker mentality on the part of unions and real pressure by corporations on the unions not to say anything when they're involved in negotiations. So there's a push-pull arrangement here, but the net result is the same, no news.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very little serious economic news, actually, in general, in any part of the media.
We're talking to Frank Emspach from Madison, Wisconsin, the founder of the Workers Independent News Service, and also John Nichols, national political correspondent from The Nation magazine. John is joining us on his cell phone, so we apologize for the quality of the call for our listeners from Massachusetts, where he's covering the gubernatorial race there. If you'd like to call in and speak with either John or Frank and talk about labor in the news, labor journalism, the number is 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, or the toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. John, what Frank was just talking about was that there is a lot of coverage of news and of economic news and affairs of workers in the press, but it's almost entirely is business news.
Well, it goes beyond that. And by the way, I affirm all the things that Frank had to add to my comments on what's happened in the but especially in radio and television, which are, of course, the places where most Americans get their news these days, the coverage, I wouldn't even call it business news. It really is business cheerleading.
Yeah.
It's almost surreal, especially on radio. They do not, on commercial radio networks, begin to analyze what's going on with corporations. You didn't hear 2 months out that Enron looked it might be in trouble or any analysis of that kind whatsoever in broadcast. You saw a little of it in print. And so Frank's exactly right that there is a little bit of an opening in radio. There's also a desperate need there. It is the vast wasteland of business coverage. And as I said before, it really is the zone of business cheerleading.
I think John is right about the business cheerleading. It's an amazing thing in the most media-saturated country of the world that nobody was talking about the imminent collapse of four or five of the largest, you know, at least by stock valuation, corporations in the country. And the exposure that this takes place, never mind the fact that when it was reported, there was one line I remember in the paper on WorldCom, 17,000 people that were going to get laid off, and about 20 paragraphs in the New York Times article on the stock issues and so on and so forth. And I think it's this kind of a sort of numbness that goes on, and the political result is very important. If people never hear about themselves, then it's very, very hard for people to come to any conclusions about what they should do about something.
Yeah, Frank, let me draw that last point you made out a little more, because I think it's pretty important. So when something like WorldCom or Enron gets covered in the business press finally, or in the news media after the collapse has taken place, sort of the immediate antenna go up, sort of seek out the effect on major investors and bondholders. The fact that lots of workers have gotten screwed over seems to be way down the list. Is that the point you were making?
That's the point, and it's not given equal weight, and it's sometimes not even mentioned. And the effects are not really drawn out. If I lose, my investments go from $120 million to $80 million, I suppose that's a tragedy. But if my situation is I go from a job to jobless and no health coverage, that's something else. And it's that kind of impact that seems to be missing.
Well, what would happen, Frank, if you worked with the labor union, or John, you can answer this one too. And you talked about how 50 years ago in the Toledo Blade, or 60 years ago, there were front page stories about labor activities to do cooperatives or to work on this measure, that measure, the stories that absolutely don't appear in our news media today. What would happen to someone from a labor union or someone just sympathetic to labor if they were working on an issue like that and they went into a newsroom at a newspaper or a broadcasting station and said, here's an interesting story, you guys, why didn't you cover it? What would the response likely be?
Well, I can offer a notion here, and generally the media in the country has gotten so far away from covering labor unions that the person from a union who went in and said, I'd like to talk to you about an initiative, would be treated much like somebody from a neighborhood association or maybe a small church that showed up and said, I'd like you to cover me. Chances are they wouldn't get any coverage, and if they did, it would be in a feature kind of throwaway mode that would, really be dismissive and give them maybe one story every 2 years. That's where the real crisis comes in.
And that result is so that it's self-fulfilling, because then
working
people don't go back.
Exactly.
You see, if there's no access, why bother? And so that contributes to a bunker mentality. I'll give you a specific example.
Okay.
We're worried about jobs moving to Mexico. Many people are worried about that, and they keep thinking about sweatshops or whatever. But about 3 weeks ago, a company that was owned by General Electric, was part of the company, which makes aircraft instruments, the place I actually used to work, announced that because the company, General Electric, was demanding that their subcontractors move high-tech instrument manufacturing to Mexico, they were going to lay off 200 people in Wilmington, Massachusetts or so, and move to Mexico, move most of it to Mexico. So there was a demonstration in front of the plant. It was a major employer in that area, highest paid wages and so forth. A couple of hundred people demonstrated, but there was not one single mention of it on any commercial newscast in the Boston metropolitan area. Now, to me, if a high-tech firm was moving out of Route 128, which is where this is, the high-tech corridor, to Merida in Mexico, I would think, even on a business thing, that might be news, never mind the fact that a couple of hundred people are losing very, very highly paid jobs. So it's that kind of blindness. Now, I can assure you that not only did every radio station in the metropolitan area get a news clip, because we provided it, but that they also got calls and asked to come to this demo, and not a single person showed up. Well, the next time something happens, that local union is probably not going to make that kind of effort. They're going to say, what's the point?
Well, can I add
please do, John.
Here too. What Frank speaks about is a good, solid local story that any media ought to be covering. And that once upon a time, media did cover quite seriously because there was a real concern about what would happen to workers. But I think we saw about a decade ago how incredibly bad the situation had gotten with the Pittston coal strike out in Virginia.
Why don't you give a little background on that, John?
Pittston, a very large coal company, one of the largest in the world, and they had a major strike at one of their largest mines. There were hundreds, Frank, you can correct me on this, was it hundreds or thousands? I know there was a very large number of workers who went out on strike, and it was a very bitter strike. And I remember there's an incredible incident where the strikers had gotten so little publicity, so little attention for so long, they decided they had to do something dramatic. So they occupied the plant, much like the Flint sit-down strike in the 1930s, which got intense national coverage and was literally covered on the radio on a breathless minute-by-minute basis. So they occupied the plant and, you know, sent out word what's happened then. You know, a labor union is doing a sit-down strike, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And they got zero coverage.
Right.
The newspapers didn't come. TV didn't come. Radio didn't come.
They did get indicted.
Yeah,
police
did,
came.
Yeah. And the incredible thing about it was, here are these workers. It's like, what if you? They were just amazed.
Well, while John is breaking up a little bit, you can do the
same thing
today. There are, I think, 30 or 40 or maybe more black farmers sitting in at the Department of Agriculture, and they've been there about 10 days now. Trying to get a meeting with the Secretary of Agriculture. I can't remember which bureau they're in, but we did a cell phone interview for them. But you look at the newspapers, there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
And these are working people. We're not only just talking about unionized working people, but in general, the concerns and issues of working people are absent. If we even take a discussion of, say, welfare, W-2, you know, new welfare as we know it.
This is up in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah, but you can talk about the temporary aid to needy families, the federal legislation. When you read stuff or listen to it on the radio, it's always from a perspective of the government or the administrators, never from the perspective of somebody who's actually trying to use this system to get a job.
We're talking to Frank Emspeck, you just listened to, from the University of Wisconsin, who's the founder of the Workers Independent News Service, and also to John Nichols, national political correspondent from The Nation magazine, who's talking to us on his cell phone from Massachusetts, and we're really grateful for him taking time out of his busy schedule to be here. If you'd like to call in and ask questions, the number is 333-9455 here on Media Matters, and our toll-free statewide number, or national number for all I know, 1-800-222-9455. We do have a caller. Urbana, you're on the air with Frank and John.
Hi. I'm concerned about the part-timing of America. Companies and institutions typically will choose to hire two part-time workers in place of one full-time worker, and they do this in order to avoid having to give benefits. It's quite an interesting shell game how the part-time agencies provide labor to large corporations and institutions and parcel these things out so that the distribution works against the worker and also prevents the worker from having the opportunity to organize because these jobs are typically very temporary and there's a flow of people in and out of these positions very quickly. I'd like to point out that locally this is a huge issue, particularly with the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. For example, the station from which you are broadcasting, the way that those employees are structured is very similar to any other corporate entity. And I have a lot of concerns about how the university exploits part-time workers on this campus. Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Okie dokie. I think we seem to have temporarily lost our guest. Is that true, guys? Yeah, it seems to be true. We're going to call and get them back in a second. In the meantime, while we're getting Frank and John back on the air, what I'd like to do is tell you a little bit about what our upcoming shows will be here on Media Matters, where I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Next week, next 2 weeks, in fact, we're going to turn to the world of advertising and consumerism and commercial culture and what that means with the sort of flood of advertising that we swim in the society. Next week, we're very fortunate to have as our guest Sut Jolly, who's the director of the Media Education Foundation. And so that's based in Amherst or Northampton, Massachusetts. And they're a group some of you might be familiar with. They do a tremendous number of educational documentaries that go out to high schools and colleges on media issues. And Sut Jolly has emerged as one of the two or three most important scholars on advertising and commercialism in our society. So we're going to have the real privilege of having Sut join us on the air live a week from today. 2 weeks from today, here on Media Matters, we're going to have two guests on the air. One will be Carrie McLaren. Carrie McLaren is the editor of a zine called Stay Free. And Stay Free is a critical quarterly publication that takes a look at advertising and consumerism as critical of the branding of society. It's several years old and has really grown into national, even international acclaim with the quality of the publication. And joining Carrie on that program in 2 weeks will be Gary Ruskin, who's the director of a group called Commercial Alert. And this is a group which basically organizes to alert people to the commercial penetration of nonprofit, non-commercial institutions and how that negatively affects the operations of those institutions, schools, museums, journalism, culture in general. You can bet that Commercial Alert will be hard at work on any campaign to sort of keep the commercialism and sponsorship to a minimum and keep what commercialism and sponsorship there is out front so people are aware of the influences over what they're experiencing with those institutions. So those are our next 2 weeks. We've got Sut Jolly. We've got Gary Ruskin and Carrie McLaren. Then 4 weeks from today, in what I think is going to be a very special show, one we've been working on for a long time, here at Media Matters, we're going to be very privileged to have as our guest for the full hour, Ed Herman. And many of you have been asking that we get Ed Herman on the show. Ed is the co-author of the seminal work, Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the News Media, which he wrote with Noam Chomsky. It was published about 14 years ago, and a new edition has just come out. He's published over 20 books on media and political economy, and I think is really one of the founding fathers, one of the great figures in doing critical news media analysis. So Ed will be our guest for the full hour 4 weeks from today, and so that should be a tremendous show. I think we have Frank Emspeck back on the line now. We're still working to get John, so eventually we're going to get John. But let's go back to Frank now.
Hi there, John. I'm here.
Hi, Frank. Thank you very much for bearing with us. I think I had a screw-up here at my end, and I pushed the wrong button.
Yeah, well, we do the same thing a lot.
I hope you don't do it as much as I do, or else you're going to be in real trouble. You know, when we were talking before, well, do you have any comments on that caller, by the way?
Well, I couldn't hear it. That's when we got, when you hit the other caller, that's when I got knocked off.
I see.
What was his question or her question?
I see. Well, it was basically just a comment about the use of temp labor in our society. Do you have, I mean, this is something, is this an issue you've been dealing with? Is this an issue that the Workers Independent News Service deals with?
Yes, because we deal not just with unionized people, but anybody. And we've done a whole series of things on temp workers. And of course, this illustrates a sort of a general problem. How do people have voice if they're not organized? You know, they're not a union or not an employer's organization. We find it a real challenge to be able to get out in the field. We cooperate with Free Speech Radio News, for instance, and they have offered us the use of many of their stringers. And to try to figure out how to go out into the community and have people speak for themselves, temporary workers, low-income people, whatever, is a real challenge. But from our perspective, that's the basis of what we do. Our job is not to editorialize so much, but is to provide a means and method for individual workers or people who are doing something to speak up on their own behalf on their own issues. So temp workers and a whole variety of circumstances, including just the job, but also stuff like medical care, have been a focus of our work.
Now, Frank, when you were talking before about how labor unions or workers groups, doesn't have to be union, will be working on what they think is a newsworthy story, and they'll go to a newsroom or they'll have a demonstration or sit in, and it doesn't get covered, and they sort of get demoralized. John tried to explain that, or did explain it to some extent, talking about now we don't have local ownership, but I mean, it just seems like, there's something more to it than that. I mean, it just seems
There's, I think, a couple of other things that have happened which are sort of interesting. First of all, in the radio news business, not only don't you have local ownership, you don't have local news anymore. So a lot of the stations are operated in a completely different way without any local news people. So there's that impediment. Secondly, and if we talk about the training of journalists today and where they come from in terms of a class, 30 or 40 years ago, many journalists were working-class people that had gotten interested in the newspaper, and so there was much more of an organic connection with their communities as opposed to now, where most people in journalism come out of school and wind up working in a community that they never lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's not a connection, a natural connection. So there's social barriers. And then I think last but not least, there is no training. So in the economic areas, in areas of concern to working people. So even if you call up and you get somebody, you need to spend a good deal of time, and this has been my experience as a labor activist, trying to explain to whoever you're talking to what's going on. And the most immediate response is, well, what does the company think? And you say, well, I don't represent the company. Go call them. And the next thing is you get into a discussion about balance. It's not my job to explain when I was doing this General Electric's position. That was their job. And so then the reporter calls them, and then you're out of the news. That's what we saw happening. And so I think there's class issues and social barrier type issues, as well as issues of ownership. And in the radio, simply the elimination of local news bureaus almost entirely.
Now, you might have heard the famous story that Jeff Cohen likes to tell, the urban legend about journalists and how they've changed from the early part of the century to the present day. It goes that back in 1929 in the newsroom of the Boston Globe, when the stock market crash came in over the wire, and it was announced in the newsroom at the Boston Globe that the market had plunged, that the journalists stood en masse and gave it a standing ovation.
Right.
They were so delighted that their bosses and all these sort of the yuppies of the 1920s had gotten their comeuppance. In 1987, the same thing took place. You know, the huge stock market crash in the fall, and all the reporters were on the phone with their brokers.
Well, I think there's that class shift for sure. But there's also been, a general blurring of things in the country. If you have no reinforcement for what you're doing, then it's very, very hard to understand your interests one way or the other. If the only interest that you have that explained to you is constantly the interest of the shareholder,
mm-hmm.
then it's very hard for you to figure out what's going on. And I think these are all reinforcing mechanisms and are crucial to our democracy. Our democracy recognizes, in theory, that there are people with differing interests, and we have a process for resolving those interests.
Mm-hmm.
Not that everybody has the same interest. Well, you don't know what your interests are if you don't have any data. And I'm not talking about just economic data, but if you think you're isolated in some place in some town or some small city someplace, and you're trying to, get, say, a minimum wage law or, health or something or better housing, and you think you're the only one, it's very easy to get discouraged. But if you hear that 150 cities throughout the United States have adopted living wage ordinances, and some of them require medical care, medical insurance, well, that gives what you're doing a totally different context. And it gives you a great deal of encouragement in all probability. So we feel that a workers' independent news service talking about issues of concern to working people will allow working people to make better judgments because they'll have more information.
We're talking to Frank Emspach today. John Nichols, unfortunately, has had to leave us. Will not be on for the rest of the year, but please do call in if you have questions for Frank. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on Media Matters. The number is 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455.
I mean, we could make this a specific discussion, right? I mean, our service is available to, you know, public radio stations, college stations, and commercial stations all over the country, including your station, right?
How many stations carry it presently?
Well, Free Speech Radio News has about 53 or 54 non-commercial subscribers, and they take a feature usually about once a week, a little bit more, a little bit less, and daily headline news, they take some of our headlines. So that would probably mean about 50 stations, maybe every other day, hear it. We also have a commercial network that distributes our stuff to their affiliates, and we think there's about 10 of those. And we have 25 stations or so that are directly subscribing to us who are taking our features and our news. So I think that on a daily basis, you could probably hear us on around 40 stations a day. And over the course of a week, throw in another 50.
We've got a caller for you, Frank, on line one from Champaign. Hi, you're on the air with Frank Emspach.
Hi.
Go ahead. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah. Hi, you're on the air with Frank Emspach.
Great. An earlier caller called in and made a comment about the coverage of local labor issues at the university here that I thought was perhaps overlooked. He had commented he felt that the coverage that WILL gave was kind of similar to the media that's more or less under the thrall of corporate interest simply because the university has such a great influence over WILL. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but just a comment I want to make. It seems to me, and I want to know if you agree, that an organization like WINS might be useful to college radio stations that are in a similar situation that maybe can't give the kind of balanced coverage they would like to give because of the influence of the university on them. What do you think of that?
Here's what...
I'll hang up now.
Okay,
thanks. You can stay on the line if you want to, but the answer is there are 616 college stations in the country. We are in the process. We have produced a specific higher education, as we call it, piece that has stuff about the entire universe of higher education, from the students' point of view, the hourly workers, academic staff, and faculty, plus headline news about other parts of the working population, plus culture and plus music. And we have a demonstration version available. We're trying to raise the money to hire the producer so that we can produce this on a daily basis. And we have the cooperation from the student station here in terms of space and studio space and volunteers. We just need to raise the money for that one producer. We're working, for instance, with the United Students Against Sweatshops and the unions that are concerned about this to do it. So we think there's a huge, huge market and a huge interest amongst college students to get news, let's say, but not only the outside world, so to speak, but about issues that are of concern to them, like tuition.
Frank, can I turn us back to a broader question about the initial comment the caller made, which was public broadcasting versus traditional commercial journalism? The caller was implying that he didn't think that workers or labor issues got a better shake in NPR or PBS or public media. What's your sense?
I would say that that's accurate so far. We have gotten no shake on public radio, with very, very few exceptions.
I mean, how much of this is due to the fact that professional journalism relies so much on official sources to legitimate news stories, and that unless they've got, like, lots of politicians and people in power clamoring about an issue, they're just not going to cover it. What this really reflects is simply the weakness of the working class or labor politically.
I think that's true, but what public radio tells us is that we're not balanced, and that in every one of our broadcasts we have to have a comment from the employer if we're talking about something. And I say, well, how come in every one of your broadcasts you don't have a comment from the workers? And so the issue that's raised with us with public radio is balance.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that balance can come from a mixture of whatever is out there plus what we're providing, as opposed to us having to provide everything sort of internally.
Well, Frank, I've got great news for you. You're getting very popular in the state of Illinois. We've got a couple people here waiting to talk to you. Let's go to them. Others who want to call in and talk to Frank M. Spack, founder of the Workers Independent News Service, which is a national radio news service talking about labor and working class economic and political issues. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let us start right here with line two. You're on the air with Frank M. Spack. Oops. Hello, you're on the air with Frank Ipsek. I'm sorry.
Is that me?
That's you. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. I'm a proud member of Local 44 in Champaign-Urbana, and I'd like to tell you that I love your show. It's one of my new favorite shows on the program.
Well, thank you.
And my comment or question is, as I'm fairly well-educated and well-read, and I wonder what, and I didn't realize about all the labor that news that used to be in the newspapers because I'm not that old. I'm about approaching 50. But I do know about the textbooks and like in schools and high schools, and there's like two pages on labor news and or labor history, and the average person has no idea what everybody went through, what all the working class people and unions did to give us the benefits that we have, the ones we haven't lost today. And I wonder if you think that has any impact on the way that journalism and everything is today. Thank you.
Is that for me, Bob?
Yeah, why don't you field that one?
Well, I think in Illinois in particular, there's been a recognition of what the speaker said because I believe the state legislature just passed a request to teach labor studies in the schools. So I think he's right that there is a general lack of knowledge, as I understood it, as what I could hear. And all of this contributes to a lack of publicity and a lack of access, I think. So long as I understood him correctly, I think his sense is
I think his point was basically the education system has done a disservice to labor history, much like journalism is doing a disservice to labor today.
Yeah, and in Illinois, unlike Wisconsin, there's been a law passed that requires the teaching of labor history in the schools now.
Okay.
At least that's my understanding. We got something here.
Well, you know, we've got two more callers, and maybe one of them is going to be able to help us. So we have two lines open. If you want to talk to Frank M. Spack, founder of the Workers Independent News Service, the number 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to line four. You're in Champaign County. You're on the air with Frank M. Spack.
Hi. Good afternoon. I wanted to chime in again on this U of I issue because I was from first-hand knowledge, I know that the temporary help marginal workers that we have at the U of I, they're very secretive about it. There was a Canadian sociologist coming in wanting to be able to interview people who were working at the U of I in this extra help capacity, and she was sorely disappointed. They wouldn't cooperate at all. I don't know if anybody's ever asked again, given the lack of popularity of that kind of investigation. And maybe the word is out, too, but they basically stonewalled her and wouldn't release any names or anything like that. So they are very sensitive about it, so you might catch
what sort of press coverage has this issue gotten in the local media, caller?
No, I don't think any. Yeah, and I don't know about this new commitment to teach labor history, and I hope it's well done. The broader issue I wanted to address was who is sponsoring? Is the AFL-CIO funding any kind of renaissance of labor journalism? I know that would be suspect because despite the fact that PBS can have, you know, Templeton funds funding the manifold business reporting and analysis, quote-unquote, that goes on PBS and the underwriting from corporations, that they're hesitant to take labor underwriting. I think the I can't remember the name of the syndicated program that was offered numerous times and has always been turned down by PBS. So, but I just wonder if anybody's working on trying to, broaden this. I like the idea of the tie to free speech radio news and the stringers and all that, but it seems like somebody needs to come in and actually underwrite it. From hearing your talk yesterday, Professor McChesney on alternative radio, you quoted a figure that there were 1,000 labor reporters some years ago, and now there's 4, if you're counting even loosely. So I'd like to just some further discussion on that. Maybe you can get your last caller in there, too. Thanks.
Well, I think we will. Thank you very much. You know, Frank, that caller really had a lot of good points. I mean,
right. First
of all, let's talk about where you get the funding for the Workers Independent News Service and you know, how, because that can't be cheap to put out a quality news show.
Well, it costs about $300,000 a year if we were fully funded We've raised a significant amount from individual contributions from different unions. We get a subscription fee from the stations that use our material, and our objective is to have the equivalent of 1.5 of our producers funded per year on that basis. That's about $75,000. We are in the process of and have had very favorable early responses from several foundations. Ultimately, we want to be what amounts to a subscription news service where individual stations or networks pay us a fee, a modest fee. I'm sure we can't mention it on the air if it's like our station, for a weekly headline news service that we produce daily for them. And we think that's the best way to go because that means we are truly independent and not dependent on any particular sources.
Now, have you found the commanding heights of the labor movement nationally or anywhere in the United States? Have they been rushing to aid you? What's been the response of organized labor to the Workers' Independent News Service?
Well, the response has been sort of interesting. I would say that initially speaking, people were simply puzzled by this whole development. And I wouldn't say rushing, but once we met with a lot of, and in one place with the, many of the communication directors and other people from the AFL-CIO unions and explained what we were trying to do, I would say we got a pretty friendly reception from about 60 or 70% of them. We were asking for a lot of money. We also have the following, and our method is very simple. We ask local unions or district of the larger international to ask their local unions to call stations. So we're in the process of negotiating somebody anyway in Rockford, Illinois, is my understanding. I think the Painters Union, but I'm not sure about that, with local stations, say, why don't you play these guys and, you know, pay them. And so we're finding state by state and bit by bit, people are beginning to call their local station and say, why don't you use this news service? So this is a whole new thing for people. But I know this is going on in Wisconsin. We know it's going on in Oregon. We understand from calls we're getting that's going on in Wyoming. We've had meetings in New York. So I figure what's happening is that there is a recognition that something needs to be done by the leadership of the AFL-CIO. And we've come up with an idea about what to do, and people are supportive.
Well, you know, how important do you think it is for labor to get something like the Workers' Independent News Service, or just more broadly to improve the quality of journalism regarding working class and labor issues, for the labor movement to have political success? I mean, what's the relationship there?
I think it's fundamental. It's not just the labor movement. It's do we have a democratic society where all voices are heard? And without being able to be heard, you can't make reasonable judgments about the world around you. So I think it's fundamental to the labor movement, for sure. But it's fundamental for anybody who's concerned about education, housing, welfare, medical care. I mean, why is it, for instance, that, well, I'll give you an example. I think it would be a very interesting thing if every single person in Kansas, let's say, knew that people in Maine were trekking off to Canada to get cheap drugs. It might influence their vision of what, you know, decent, drug care might look like, you know. But if they never hear about it, they're never going to be able to, say, compare their existence to somebody else's existence. So I think what we're trying to do and the general broadening of and opening up of the media is fundamental not only to the labor movement, but to the long-term growth and stability of our democracy.
We're talking to Frank Emspach today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We do have the lines open and time for another call or two. If you call right away, the number 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Frank, what about there's been a whole pile of labor newspapers. Ever since there's been a labor movement, you had labor unions with their own publications and newspapers. Early in the 20th century, these oftentimes were actually quite prominent and widely read. Do we still have labor papers today, and what's their status?
Well, we still have labor papers today. If we talk about ones produced by, say, local labor councils, that is a group of unions, let's say, in Rockford or in Chicago or something, there are a significant number of those. Some of them are very good journalistically. Some of them are not. And a lot of people, in general, don't read them no matter what. The problem is, in general, people don't read. And in specific, working people tend not to read. And then you get into the questions of, is the journalism really good? or the paper is cheerleading for a particular officer or a particular union.
And you're trying to keep an independence from any specific union or federation so that no one will think you're shilling for them?
Well, our board has different unions on it, but it also has community organizations and rank-and-file activists on it.
We've got a caller for you right now, Frank, from line one. Urbana, you're on the air with Frank Emspeck.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
I have a wild-ass dream I'd like to run by you in a comment. I think part of what the problem, I think you would agree with me on this point, what we're discussing here is the fact that the media in general is owned less and less, or I'm saying this wrong, the media in general is owned by very few players whose interests are not necessarily those of the public at large. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
What do you think the chances are, probably not likely in this present political environment, but what do you think the chances are that one day we may, to counter that, perhaps have a governmentally funded independent media mechanism that could discuss and address the issues that we're talking about here today, completely free of any bias or input by, you know, sponsors and corporate owners and so on and so forth? What do you think of that? Is it just
too
half-baked, or is there a hope, perhaps?
I think I would rather answer it this way. I don't think there's much hope, but there are things that can be done that will allow us to increase the presence of all kinds of people on the radio. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is a funder of National Public Radio, the budget's always being cut. And I think one place to begin to broaden what's available is to fight for more funding for the corporation, which gives out grants to many community stations, may give out grants to people like us. And so that mechanism may begin to open up some kind of public support for, say, broader visions on the media. And that's a very minor step that we could take. NPR is what was supposed to be what you're talking about. And to the extent that it's underfunded and feels under the gun from Congress, they're very, very leery about broadcasting things that they think will result in a cut in their appropriation.
Well, you know, this gets us a little bit off the trail of labor radio, but what the caller's referring to, there are actually many people, economists and policymakers, working on ways to come up with have a funding an independent, nonprofit, non-commercial, viable sector for our media system. One of them is an economist named Dean Baker, who's an outstanding economist. We're hoping to have Dean as a guest on the show to talk about some of his ideas later in the year. Frank, you know, we don't have a lot of time left, and I think there's a couple practical things I'd like to end up the show on. Mm-hmm. First of all, where do you find out about what's happening with labor? I mean, where do your if for one of our listeners, they want to how do they get a hold of the WINS to begin with?
Go to www.laborradio.org. That's the easiest thing to do.
Okay.
They can call me at the University of Wisconsin, which, as it turns out, a lot of people do. They can send email. I think between the two producers and myself, we probably get about 200 emails a day at least.
And I assume they can just go through that website of laborradio.org?
Yeah, www.laborradio.org.
And that'll set you up. Okay, well, what about print media? What would you recommend to people who want to read a little bit? Where would you look to see coverage of labor?
Well, that's the problem. If you're talking about national press, there is none. There are specific labor papers like Labor Notes, for instance, which is basically a very progressive labor journal. Then there are the individual union papers, like, you know, any particular international union has a newspaper. Many of the unions now have websites, but you're right. If you wanted to get a general interest publication that focuses on labor, particularly a daily, there is none. If you wanted weekly or monthly, Labor Notes, the magazine Dollars and Cents is another. Maybe In These Times, which is published in Chicago, is a third. But that's about it. There is no labor voice. And the reason we set up our voice for radio is that we know through surveys and whatnot that 38% of all working people listen to the radio between 5:30 a.m. and 8 o'clock in the morning. And we figured, well, if that's the case, If we can get on in every market, then people will hear the news about workers, and then maybe other things will develop.
How many markets are carrying your service now in Illinois? Do you know offhand?
I don't know. We are talking about with WEFT. Is that near area?
It certainly is. It's our local community station.
Right. I think that they are carrying it. At, I know
my engineer is giving me the no sign with his head, so I think if they're feeding you a line of goods.
Well, they're not carrying it. I know we've been in correspondence with them. And I know that we're talking to a union in the northern part of the state about having it put on commercial radio. And we've been playing phone tag. They have told me what they're going to do, and I need to verify it with their business agent.
I didn't mean to get you alarmed there. I just found out I got a more detailed message. WEFT is working on the contract with you. It's going to go through.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Don't, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
I mean, this is difficult for everybody because – our thing is really this. If this is important, all of us, all progressive people, are going to try to fight to get our news on commercial radio and non-commercial radio in ways that make sense. And that's what we're trying to stimulate here.
You know, Frank,
that will guarantee our independence.
You know, back in the teens and the 20s and the 30s, back in the era of the Federated News, leading figures in organized labor in both the AFL and CIO worked hard to set up labor radio stations like WCFL in Chicago and
right.
a series of FM stations.
Right.
And there was a vast amount of resources that went to setting up a real independent labor media. Is there any sentiment in organized labor to devote those sort of resources today, or is that basically forgotten?
I think it's not forgotten, but I don't think the resources are there in quite the same way. I think that in many ways people see public relations and not news and as their problem. And, of course, if you are an individual organization, you have to worry about how your organization is perceived. And so that's public relations. News is different. And I think from our perspective as a news organization, there's a major difference.
Mm-hmm.
And we are trying to work with people who are brought up and whose job it is to be public relators, so to speak. And that's communications directors are public relations people, and we're talking about something different. And so it's a hard transition for people to make. But we are finding receptivity at all levels, and not just with labor. I think that's what's important.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Tenants and Workers Resource Center. We have the National Employment Law Project on our board. We have people from the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, and their whole national organization is in touch with us. When you say, where do we get stories, we may get a call from the Tenants and Workers or the National Employment Law Project or somebody else and say, hey, look, such and such is happening so-and-so place. Can you cover it?
All right. Well, Frank M. Speck, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today on Media Matters.
And it's a pleasure.
We're going to keep following the Workers Independent News Service, and I hope our listeners, if they're interested, will get the laborradio.org on the Internet and stay on top of it and listen to it when it comes to WEFT.
And I hope we can get it on your station.
Well, we're going to get in the community. That's what counts now.
Marvelous.
All right. Well, thanks again, Frank. And I want to take this moment right before we go off the air to thank my producer today, Doug Miller, who ably sat in for the two Bens, the main producers who are out of town. And thank you all for listening to Media Matters.